This show is part of the Electric Agora network of podcasts.
Hello, hello. This is Rob Gressis. I'm a professor at California State University, Northridge, and I am recording a discussion today with Hugo Mercier for Sophia TV. Hugo, why don't you tell us where you're from?
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. I am from, I work in Paris at the Institut Jean Nicot. I am a CNRS researcher there. And I work on cognitive psychology.
Cognitive psychology. Well, we're going to talk about your book today. It's, I'm so unprepared. I don't have the book next to me. I usually like to have the book.
That's great. Okay.
Oh, there we go. I see it. I'll show it to the camera. We have his book, Not Born Yesterday, that we're going to be discussing. But first, I want to do some small talk to make the guests feel more comfortable. So, Hugo, have you ever been convicted of a crime?
I have not.
You have not? All right, why not?
So I could have been, I guess, at some point, but I was lucky enough not to. Yeah.
Oh, all right. So you were on the wrong side of the tracks for a while, but then you shaped yourself up. Okay, yeah.
Exactly.
I also have never been convicted of a crime, and it's not for lack of trying, but all right. Well, this is our plight. So let's talk about your book, Not Born Yesterday. The subtitle is The Signs of Who We Trust and What We Believe. What's interesting about your book, I mean, there's many interesting things about your book, but one of the things that stands out about your book is that you say that people are a lot less gullible than a lot of people think. And if they do have a problem, it's probably that they're too untrusting. And this is very striking right now because in America, there's a lot of worry about a few things. So on the right, a lot of conservatives are worried that college professors and the media are gonna brainwash people and make them all believe left-wing things.
You wish.
You wish. And on the left, people are very worried about something called QAnon, which I confess I haven't really looked into QAnon very much. I get the sense it's some kind of conspiracy-minded cult-like organization. I don't know that it is, in fact, a cult.
An organization, really.
Yeah, right. But conspiratorial, it does seem to be. And I think the New York Times estimated that something like 3 million people are believers in the QAnon conspiracy or something like that. Mm-hmm. What it means to be a believer is left unstated in the article, and, mm-hmm. and it's unfortunate because after reading your book, I would really like to know what they mean by being a believer. Mm-hmm. But let's start with the basic sort of empirical groundwork of your theory, mm-hmm. and then we're going to apply it to things like the QAnon conspiracy. So mm-hmm. there's a bunch of cognitive psychologists or cultural psychologists, I don't know what to call them, but people like a guy named Joe Henrich at Harvard University, who say that by and large, people are primed to be very imitative. There's three kinds of biases. They're called biases, but three kinds of dispositions people have. One is called a success bias. So if you see somebody who's successful at doing something, you want to imitate them. One is called a prestige bias. Mm-hmm. So if you see somebody who's highly regarded or highly respected or just very famous, you want to imitate them. And the last one I think is called the conformity bias or majority bias, mm-hmm. where if lots of people are doing something, you want to do it. And mm-hmm. the thought is that it's because we have these three biases that we can have culture. So the biases are very useful, but on the other hand, they make us very manipulable. And so this is why people are gullible. The good thing is that it helps us have a culture, but the bad thing is that it makes us easily manipulable by advertising, by demagogues, by silly religious beliefs, that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. what's your response to this story, which I gather is widely shared among a lot of psychologists?
Yes. My response is that to some extent, I can see how this theory kind of makes sense in the sense of very kind of broad heuristics, and mostly it might make sense in the main domain to which they apply it to, which is imitation. So if you see people doing something then, you know, imitating them to some extent, you know, or, you know, imitating is usually the stronger word, but, you know, being influenced by what they're doing, trying to understand what they're doing and to see if it would be good for us to do it as well, is broadly sensible. And that's because if they are doing something, it's a good enough cue that they actually think it's worthwhile. Like, you know, if you see people going to a restaurant, you know, they're actually eating the food and everything. So they're sending a relatively honest signal that they think it's a good restaurant. By contrast, when it comes to communication, there, if I just, you know, telling someone, well, this restaurant is great, it's very cheap because I don't actually have to go to the restaurant myself. I can think it's really bad and you know, still, you know, recommend it to you. And so the same principles, which might sort of make sense. I don't even really think they apply there, but that might sort of make sense for imitation and for behavior, completely break down when it comes to communication, because there would be nothing to stop, you know, famous people, as you were saying, or even, you know, like a majority of people if they could coordinate, or the people who are successful in some respect, to then, you know, use their, you know, huge influence on others to just derive, you know, benefits for themselves at a cost to others. And so I think that the theory kind of breaks down when it comes to communication. And indeed, I think there's a formidable amount of evidence showing that in the case of communication, even though we use things that are a little bit like these heuristics, like, you know, if someone is very good at computers, you will be more likely to take their advice when it comes to computers. If everybody around you agrees on something, you'll be more likely to believe it. We do that in a way that is very discerning, and we're very careful of, you know, potential manipulation attempts of, and where, you know, it's much more subtle than the kind of, you know, very kind of rough heuristics that they would describe.
Yeah. So if I understand you correctly, the main reason to think that this story, even if it is good at explaining why we have a culture, the main reason it breaks down when it comes to communication is that if it worked to explain communication, then it would mean certain people would just be too easy to get what you want. And we just don't see that happening. And so the successful would be able to manipulate people into doing whatever they want. The prestigious would be able to do the same thing. The majority would be able to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't happen. People aren't that manipulable if you look at the evidence. Yeah. But then, you know, people are going to say to you something like, but look, there's, you have the cases of people like Hitler who got his people to believe all sorts of crazy things. You have the cases of Pol Pot who managed to make glasses wearing a capital offense. We'd be in big trouble in the Khmer Rouge. And you have, and just to take a more recent example, you have 75 million Americans or so who voted for Donald Trump, which a lot of people think was deeply irrational, and that the only reason they did that was because he sort of tricked them or manipulated them into doing it. So how do you respond to these cases? Some people are going to say, yeah, it is incredibly easy to manipulate people. That's the problem.
Yes, well, that's factually wrong. And so we tend to confuse very easily the direction of causation. So when we have something like, you know, like all the examples you've given, something like a demagogue or a dictator who says stuff and then the population seems to abide by what the you know, the person he's in charge is saying, it always feels as if, well, you know, they're doing it because they're obeying, or they've been brainwashed, or they just, you know, they're being influenced by the propaganda. When in fact, in most cases, the causality goes the other way around, in that the person is in charge will you know, advocate certain policies because they think the population will like them. And so, and even in dictatorships, someone like Hitler was actually very, very sensitive to public opinion. It was obviously, it's really hard to know what public opinion is in Germany, because if you said the wrong thing, you might be, you know, shot and stuff. But they're trying really hard, the Nazis, to try to figure out, precisely because it is so hard for a dictator to know what the people are thinking. And yet it is so important, because if everybody hates them, there will be a coup. And so they're trying really hard to get at what the population thinks, and to adapt to some extent what they're doing to what the population would like. Obviously, there are, you know, they have fewer constraints than in the democracy, but they're not completely blind to that. And the talent of demagogues, and that was very clear for Hitler, and, you know, I don't want to draw an easy analogy, but it's also true for Trump, for instance, is a talent for finding things that the crowd will want to hear. Mm-hmm. And so most of the causality goes from, you know, the crowd to the public to demagogues and populists rather than the other way around. And so we have quite a bit of evidence for that. For instance, There was a lovely paper on the effect of Hitler's campaign speeches. So he campaigned a lot, and he was very innovative in his campaign and in the way he campaigned. Well, he was still, you know, not elected before being a dictator in the late 20s and the early 30s. And that paper suggests that his multiple campaign speeches had no effect on the Nazi vote share on the whole. Mm-hmm. Even though everybody looked at him like, wow, you know, it's amazing what he's doing. He's using loudspeakers, he's using planes to go to different places and covering a lot of ground. None of that seemed to have any effect. And we also see, for instance, that Hitler, he shifted his rhetoric completely during these campaign years, so that he would mostly focus on being anti-communist, which was a very popular message, rather than being only anti-Semitic, which was more kind of his thing. And that even though, you know, Germany, German population was very much anti-Semitic, they didn't see that as an like, extremely pressing political issue. And so he adapted his message to what he thought, and rightly, the population wanted to hear, rather than shaping what the population was thinking.
Okay, good. So let me just see if I understand your answer correctly so I can recapitulate it. A lot of people think what happens with figures like Hitler and to a lesser extent Trump is that they say things that people find silly, but they manage to make them believe it through the sheer force of will or sheer force of rhetoric. But what actually happens is that there's a large segment of the population who wants something that maybe they're not being served that. Hitler, Trump, whoever discovers what they want and starts to articulate that, and that makes them popular. So it's not that they're causing people to believe silly things, it's that the people kind of already believe these silly things, or maybe we shouldn't even say it like that. The people already wanted certain things. Mm-hmm. And people like Hitler and other demagogues figured out what they wanted and just started saying, I'll give you what you want. And that's what made them popular. So that's why somebody like Hitler had to be very sensitive to public opinion. Why do you think his rhetoric, his speeches, his various speeches, from what I know, I've actually never seen Hitler give a speech. I've only seen that famous clip they share on YouTube of that German movie where he gets really angry. But I've heard it said that he was quite a good rhetorician. I don't know if that's true or not, but let's say it's true. Why didn't his speeches do more to make him more popular, do you think?
Well, you know, because there might be a major sampling bias. It's at the beginning, you know, before he was a dictator and people were pretty much, you know, forced to attend his speeches, the people who would attend his speeches were people who were presumably already interested in this kind of message. And so you see the crowd resonate because he is good at you know, playing with the crowd and at finding out what the crowd wants to hear. But then again, the people who are going there are already people who are likely, you know, Nazi voters. Yeah. And so, you know, it's not just a good way of reaching out. Like people who are really like communists who don't go to the rallies, or if they went, then they would just remain, you know, kind of communist leaning. But it still shows how important these people can be in that it allows a group of people whose voice maybe weren't heard in politics or not as much as they wanted to realize how powerful they could be and how many of them there are. And so that can have very important effects. Like it allows people to organize and to coordinate. And that can have obviously kind of dramatic effects. But it's not persuasion per se.
So it seems like his main effect was an emboldening effect rather than a persuading effect. There's a bunch of people who would be receptive to his message and a bunch of people who wouldn't be. The ones who wouldn't be, he really couldn't make them receptive, short of like threat of force. And the ones who were receptive to his message, he could sort of let them know that there are other people out there receptive to the same message, especially if it hadn't been overtly stated. And then they're like, hey, this is awesome. So, and presumably the same sort of thing happens with not just people like Trump, but even, well, here, like with somebody like Biden, right? Who, you know, people don't think of Biden as a demagogue. But like, does he have a similar effect on his base that somebody like Trump would have on his base? Or is it different because you think maybe Biden's messages are so often kind of pronounced through lots of different segments of academia or the media or Hollywood or whatever?
I guess here, yeah, I mean, the issue is that his views are more, obviously, kind of more consensual and more kind of mainstream. And as a result, you know, there's no reason really for him to be welcome as this, you know, kind of really kind of messianic figure who will, you know, finally be the first to give you a voice in the political arena, because everybody, you know, is very kind of middle ground and everything. So, I mean, he's actually acting in a way that is much less middle ground than people might have feared. So that's, which is probably good, but so you can see how, yeah, you don't get to gain the same status if you're, you know, just in the continuation of people who are broadly saying the same thing as you. So you don't, you know, you don't get special points for having, for giving a voice, so to speak, to people who didn't really, or who felt they didn't have one. So there is, unfortunately, there's some kind of asymmetry there, and it's harder to be, but in the sense that, you know, all good politicians are, you know, populist to some extent. I mean, you know, and it is a good thing that they adapt to what the people are thinking and what they think that people think. I mean, it would be kind of worrying if they completely neglected public opinion. And so you, oftentimes when you call someone a populist, it's just because you disagree with the people who they, you know, who they serve. So,
yeah.
So, you know, everybody, you know, people on the right are branding Bernie Sanders a populist, and then vice versa. So it's, you know, it's not clear what differentiates, you know, I mean, there's a lot of political, good political science work on that, but it's not the, you know, the boundary between the populist and a normal politician isn't really clear.
So let me step back a bit and take an aggressive attack on your view. So let's say that somebody says this. Yeah, of course, people aren't that gullible as a class, right? I wasn't saying Trump could like make all Americans believe that the earth is flat just because so many Americans hate Trump. But here's something that seems clear. I know a Trump voter, and I don't think I could ever get her to vote for Biden. And I know many, many, many Biden voters, and I don't think I could ever get them to vote for Trump. But it does seem as though I think what's called the Overton window, which talks about like what is publicly acceptable to say and not say, has really changed a lot on both the right and the left. So I think in 2012, if you were like a major Democratic politician and you had said that America is a white supremacist country, I think that would have probably been something of a scandal for you. Whereas in 2012, if you had been a major Republican politician and said half the things Trump said, that would have been a career finisher. And yet now it seems like people on the right, like most Republicans from what I've seen, believe that the election was fraudulent, the recent presidential election. And lots of Democrats, I think, are believing things about race, sex, and gender now that 8 years ago would have been considered quite radical. So it seems like opinion has shifted and shifted extremely quickly. And there's not just this, you have the case of Barack Obama. I think the Black community in the United States was fairly significantly against gay marriage in 2008 or 2009. I think it was actually 2011 when Obama announced he was in favor of gay marriage. But I think the percentage of the Black community who was against gay marriage shifted almost overnight from 54% to only 36%, right? And so I might be getting those numbers wrong, but it was something that dramatic. Mm. And so maybe the view is not that people as a whole are gullible, but when it comes to politicians who tell them things they want to hear, they're incredibly gullible. So how do you explain why people are so willing to believe things for which there's not really good evidence, like that the election was stolen, or things that they used to not at all believe, like about, you know, the racist nature, the more deep set racist nature of the country than they had believed before?
No, that's a good question. In some cases, like the fact that the election was stolen, it might be that the politician is merely reinforcing people's priors instead of really challenging them and giving people an excuse for kind of refusing the mainstream media or the actual truth, but what they see as just kind of the mainstream media message. And so, like, for instance, if you're a Trump voter and everybody you know voted for Trump and you've been to Trump rallies and it feels as if, you know, your intuition is that there was like this massive degree of support for Trump. Mm-hmm. And then you see that he actually lost the election. It requires a lot of trust in the institutions and in the media for you to overcome your initial intuition. And so if Trump tells you then, well, you know, actually the election was stolen, it's not a huge leap for you to you know, to go from your evidence that suggests the same to what he's saying and to reject the mainstream media view, and which is again actually the truth in that case, obviously. In other situations, like the case of the of black folks shifting on gay marriage, it is possible that their opinions weren't that strong to start with. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, I would, you know, if there had been some like a reverse thing, that like you would think that, you know, gay people wouldn't have started being against gay marriage because Obama had flipped the other direction or something. So something that is quite well established that for in domains in which people have relatively weak opinions or what political scientists call non-attitudes, like things they don't really care about all that much, and they have an opinion because, you know, when you ask them what they think in an opinion poll, they're going to say something, but they really, it's not something they feel very strongly about, then they will follow cues from elites and from politicians that they do respect. So once a politician has earned their trust by doing things and saying things that are broadly, that are coherent with their kind of more kind of core values, then they can influence them at the margin, for sure, yeah.
Okay, so like this leads to the question of belief. And this, I think, starts to get to your earlier work, The Enigma of Reason with Dan mm-hmm. Sperber. But let's, so when people say that there were 3 million people at Trump's inauguration rally, or they say the election was stolen, but if you ask them for evidence, you know, they'll talk to you about things they saw on Fox News or on Newsmax or OAN, and they'll say things like, well, there are all these people who claim they saw the things, you know, so they'll provide things that look like evidence. Mm-hmm. How strongly do you think they believe that? And to take a more extreme example, take the QAnon people. I don't know exactly what the QAnon people believe. I do think it starts to get into, isn't there something about Jewish laser guns or something like that? I don't know.
I don't know.
But yeah, anyway.
But
you mentioned in your book, the flat earth people, and the flat earth people claim that there's a 200-foot tall wall of ice or whatever that prevents you from going to the other side of the earth by boat or something. I don't quite know.
If you take a globe and you start from the North Pole and you try to flatten it, Hello Kitty. And so you flatten it, and what you get, obviously, you get, you know, Antarctica all around the globe because that's what was at the bottom. So if you just, you know, up it like this. And so they think that Antarctica is actually a wall of ice that surrounds the Earth and that stops you from falling over, presumably.
Oh, okay. All right. So
it makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah.
I mean, does it make sense? I don't have, I have to confess, I don't have like strong intuitions about how geology works. So I think if I were a geologist, it would not make sense, but sure, it makes sense on some folk level. So do they actually believe these things? And what does it mean to really believe something? So your book distinguishes between two kinds of beliefs, but why don't you elaborate?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the view I suggest following Dan Sperber, who had created this theoretical framework, is a distinction between intuitive and reflective beliefs.
Yeah.
And so intuitive beliefs are the kind of beliefs you form, for instance, through perception. So, you know, I can see there's a desk in front of me. I can see the window there. You know, I can hear my children next in the room next door, and I have intuitive beliefs about, you know, where my children are, where my desk is, and I can base my behavior on that. I can draw inferences from that. These beliefs are just kind of roaming freely with my other beliefs, so they can interact with everything I believe, and you know, just normal cognition takes place.
Yeah.
By contrast, reflective beliefs are kept kind of insulated from the rest of our beliefs. And so they don't really interact with any other belief, and they don't, you know, they can't really create much damage, or, you know, they're not really directly linked to our behavior or to other inferences we might draw. And what's important to keep in mind is that, so for instance, an example of reflective belief could be, you know, my belief in quantum, you know, in quantum theory, like, you know, I believe that it's, you know, or, you know, relativity theory. I believe that relativity theory is correct, but it doesn't mean anything to me. It's not related to any, I can't, you know, I'm not acting, you know, at all on that basis. I'm not doing anything with it. And so it's important to distinguish that from the degree of confidence you have, because I'm very confident that relativity theory is correct. And I can also have intuitive beliefs that I'm not really confident in. Like if I think I hear something, you know, I think there's someone else in the house, but I'm not sure. So that's still completely intuitive. And so it's important to keep that in mind, because that means that people can have beliefs that they hold very, very confidently, like, you know, some scientific or religious beliefs. And yet that these beliefs are held reflectively, and that as a result, they are not going to have any kind of behavioral or cognitive consequences. So people believe them and they're truthful, they're not lying, they're not deceiving themselves, they're really believing in these things, but it still doesn't impact their behavior in any meaningful manner.
Okay, so the thought then could be that, like, the QAnon people really do believe what they're saying. Mm-hmm. It's just that most of them aren't going around. So I think from what I know, it's not technically true that part of the QAnon conspiracy is that there's a child pederasty ring in Cosmic Pizza or whatever it was called, but
in the Comet Ping Pong Pizza. It was kind of an antecedent, I guess, of it. Yeah.
But there, it's like adjacent to that. So like there's some interaction, there's a pipeline, let's say. And, but if you really did believe that the election was stolen, or you did really believe there was a pederasty ring, you'd think there'd be a lot of people. Like if there are 3 million QAnon believers, you'd think a lot of them would start to do violent stuff to protect the nation. Or you'd think a lot of them would do violent things to stop a child pederasty ring. But there was only one person who tried to stop the pederasty ring. And then as for the violent stuff, there was obviously a big riot on the Capitol, but it's not clear to me if all the people who showed up intended to do that. Certainly, it's not clear to me that all the people who went to that violent event knew what was going to happen or intended to commit violence when they got there. Some seemed to be intending to do that, but I would think most of them were sort of like, whoa, this is interesting. You know, we can go into the Capitol. How cool is that? So the thought then is that even these people who truly believed the election was stolen believed it reflectively, whereas the ones who were actually going to commit violence believed it intuitively. Is that fair to say?
Like possibly, at least it's possible that the people who actually acted in line with their beliefs did believe that intuitively. So yeah, as you were saying, like, in the case of Pizzagate, there's this one guy who took his gun and who tried to actually went to that pizzeria in the suburbs of DC and try to get the owners to open a non-existent door into a non-existent basement to free some non-existent children. And now he's, I don't know, you know, he might have been released by now, but you know, he spent a number of years in jail. And whereas most people who supposedly believed in Pizzagate either did absolutely nothing at all, or some of them left, you know, one-star reviews on the pizzeria, which is completely kind of morally monstrous as a reaction to, you know, to pedophilia and child abuse. And so yes, clearly there's like a strong disconnect for most people between what they believe and what they genuinely believe and what they actually do. And even in the case of the Capitol, apparently quite a lot of the people who stormed the Capitol hadn't even voted. And so it was before, obviously, they thought the action was stolen, so they didn't, you know, because if Trump had won, they would not have believed the action was stolen. And so, you know, on the one hand, they are ready to do something for, you know, for Trump to win. On the other hand, they can't even bother to vote, which suggests that then again, there's, you know, the connection between their behavior and their belief isn't exactly transparent.
Yeah, let me pause on this for a second, because I think the connection between belief and behavior is generally not transparent to me. So for instance, if I thought there was a pederasty ring and it was frequented by the most powerful people in the world, I don't know that I would go try to stop it, not because I don't care about children, but because I don't want to get killed, right? I might think that Seth Rich was murdered and that I'll be the next Seth Rich. And so I wouldn't see that as out of line with their beliefs. As for the people who didn't vote, well, didn't this happen in Georgia? Like there was somebody named Lynn Stone who was basically telling everybody that, look, the election is fraudulent. There's no point in even voting. And Trump didn't denounce this person. And so I think a lot of Trump supporters were demoralized. And so a lot of conservatives blame Trump for the 2 Senate losses in Georgia on the thought that, like, you know, you've depressed turnout. And so if I thought the election was gonna, well, here's the thing. obviously you said they didn't vote before the election happened, but Trump was preparing the groundwork that if he loses, the election will be fraudulent.
Yeah.
I could imagine people saying, oh, he's going to lose because they hate him too much and not voting. So all I'm saying is that I don't know.
Yeah, no,
I don't know how somebody would act, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. No, it's hard. I agree. Yeah. But in the case of what you bring up about conspiracy theories and what people should do is interesting, because one of the nice examples, I think, of dissociations between different types of beliefs in conspiracy theories is if you have an intuitive belief in a conspiracy theory, usually you're going to shut up. Like if you're in Pakistan and you think that the Secret Service of Pakistan has killed your uncle or something, you're going to shut the hell up and not try not to get killed. And if you're in the US and you believe that the NSA or whatever blew up the World Trade Center, you're going to shout that from the rooftops, even though you're believing that these people can kill with impunity, they're super powerful, they can do whatever they want. Apparently, with the exception of killing a random blogger who wants to tell about the truth about 9/11. So clearly, and there's this beautiful book about these truthers, people who believe that 9/11 was an inside job, and the journalists, most of these people are very vocal about their beliefs, which makes no sense. But a few of them are genuinely kind of holed up in their basements with no communication at all, just trying to protect themselves from these super powerful institutions, which is the coherent thing to do. Instead of voicing out like look, the NSA, they killed thousands of people, but somehow I can say that without them, without any fear of reprisal.
Yeah. I mean, I think one could still say something that raises questions about the belief action connection, but it reminds me of an incident that happened yesterday to me. My wife, she was going over to a friend's house, and this friend had had the coronavirus. He'd already had it and recovered from it. And so she and I have followed, quote, the science about this a bit, a few hours a week, right? And I'm under the impression, and I've talked to people who know a lot more about this than I do, that once you've had it, it's at least, especially if you've had it very recently, and so he had it and he did the 2-week quarantine, then you're not gonna like get it again to spread it to other people.
Very likely, yeah.
Yeah, and so she went over to his house, and then he said, "Okay, we'll talk outside." And she said, "Why? You've had it?" And he said, "Just better be safe." Mm-hmm. And she was a little bit baffled because there was no need. I mean, he'd had it, but she complied, and she told him, I think, about, well, no, you can't get it again right now. Your antibodies will prevent it from like getting in and that kind of stuff, and it just wouldn't work. So it's like, is this a case where the reflective belief and the intuitive belief are at odds? Like for me, they're not at odds, I guess, because I'd be perfectly happy going to a room full of people who've had COVID and talking with my mask off and yelling in each other's mouths. But him, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't know. So in these kind of cases, it is possible that, like you might imagine, let's say you've had COVID and you completely sure you've had the symptoms, you've been tested, you're as sure as it can be that you've had it. So in the case of that person, that friend of your wife's talking with your wife, it doesn't really apply maybe in particular, but more generally, you see why that person would want to follow the norms and the rules in terms of mask wearing and social distancing, because most people don't know they've had COVID. Mm-hmm. And so people are just going to think of them, well, look, they're horrible because they're breaking all the rules and they can't explain, but it's fine because I've had COVID and then, people have to trust you that you've had it, etc. So I can see how both are as a just pure precaution, like to be, an abundance of caution, you're still following the rules, but also not only just in terms of kind of epidemiology, but in terms of social norms. It's better maybe if you stick to the rules so that you don't get shunned or ostracized or whatever, you don't suffer negative social repercussions for doing something that is actually okay, but that people won't believe is okay because they don't have all the information.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not saying he should go out without a mask, but like when it's a private, when it's just him and her in his house, right? Like there's nobody who's gonna know about the norms. I guess he's internalized them so much that he just feels uncomfortable violating them even in his own private home. And, you know, I see people driving cars by themselves with masks on. And I'm just so confused. Like, you're by yourself in your car.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this? And so is that that's all compatible with your story? It's just too habitual, or people are not very good at being nuanced about how they implement their beliefs?
Yeah, to some extent, I would think that there's some of that. I mean, you know, we do rely on heuristics to some extent. And if we think, well, okay, I just have to wear a mask when I'm outside, it's maybe easier for us to just always do it rather than to constantly adjust. Okay, so now I'm more than 2 meters away from someone, so I can take off my mask, and now I'm 2 meters. So, you know, it's just so much simpler to just have a simple rule to follow, and you know, maybe you're much likely to break it, and it's just so there are some benefits to that. It looks, you know, less adaptive, but it might be actually better for most people.
Yeah, I wonder if they shower with their masks on, but I'll leave that to a different
hopefully
day.
When they're inside, they can take them off. Yeah.
I hope. So this starts to lead to a different question, which is in your previous book, The Enigma of Reason, you have this theory called the argumentative theory of reason. I think it's called that, right? And the theory, I'm going to butcher it because it's been a year or so since I read your book, but it's something like, when it comes to arguments, there's basically two kinds of ways you use them. Prospectively, to try to figure something out that hasn't happened. So like, if you're trying to figure out what the best move in a Sudoku game is, it hasn't happened yet. And you know, the arguments in that case really are motivating and really are causally efficacious because, you know, you've ruled out all the possibilities, this one's left. But in many cases, I don't know about most, but in many cases, arguments are retrospective. They are meant to rationalize or justify a behavior, and they're meant in particular to justify it or rationalize it to other people. Basically, they're much more about our reputation than they are about finding truth. And so okay, so stop me.
We did call that the argumentative theory of reason. In the book, we kind of shifted towards the interactionist theory of reason, in part because we still think that reasoning and reason more generally, so this cognitive ability we have of finding and of evaluating reasons, we still think it serves argumentation. So it's all, you know, to convince people and to see whether you should be convinced or not when someone gives you an argument. But we, as you are mentioning, we also think that it serves to justify our behaviors and our thoughts, as you were saying, so that we can keep a good reputation, either as someone who is, you know, competent or someone who is morally apt. And so it is true that what we think is that mostly when you're finding reasons, when you're reasoning on your own, what you're doing is mostly retrospective. So you start from a behavior that you've had or from a thought that you have, and you think of reasons that will either try to convince someone else to share that thought, or that it will allow you to justify the behavior or that thought to others. But when you are then exposed to someone else's arguments and to someone else's reasons and justifications, then you act in a way that is much more objective. And your goal is to figure out whether the reasons are good enough that you should change your mind. Mm-hmm. And that's when reason really helps you actually acquire better beliefs, either about the world or about, you know, other people's actions. So on the whole, it still works as a way of getting at the truth to some extent. Like if you're talking with others, if you're exchanging arguments with people, you will form, as a rule, more accurate beliefs. But if you're reasoning on your own, as a rule, it's not going to work so well.
Okay. So basically, one of the things, so people have, you talk about something you call plausibility checking in your book. People have lots of conclusions they believe. And then if somebody says something to them that is at odds with one of the conclusions they believe, they become suspicious of it. Whereas if somebody says something in line with what they believe, they don't become suspicious of it. Mm-hmm. But when you have like diverse communities, where diverse in this case means intellectually diverse, believing different things, then what happens is that you have this interaction, as you said, and people start to have to give reasons for their conclusions, right? You have the really nice example of bloodletting. How bloodletting was a fairly worldwide phenomenon, but only in a few places did people come up with theories that explain why bloodletting works. And the reason this happened was that most people thought bloodletting was just naturally obvious, right? If something bad is in you, cut yourself and let it out.
Yeah.
But in places where Galen was, it was a very diverse community intellectually. So he had to come up with a whole theory justifying bloodletting. And he came up with the four humors and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought then would be that when there's lots of interaction with people who disagree with us, then we will get better at argumentation and our positions will be more well-reasoned. Okay. Is that the thought?
Well, yes. And not only do our positions become better reasoned, but we know people do change their minds. So the bloodletting example is a good one in the sense that it illustrates the social constraints on people producing justifications. But in that case, no one really changed their minds because, as you were saying, most people are naturally inclined towards bloodletting for a variety of reasons. But when there is, when people disagree about some matter of fact and then they start exchanging arguments about it, as a rule, the person who has the best answers or, the best answers combined between different people will carry the day. They will win and they will spread throughout the group. And people will end up with better beliefs than they started with.
Okay, so I have a counterexample, Twitter. So on Twitter, I see lots of people doing one of two things. One, lots of people are staying in what I think has trendily been called their epistemic bubbles, where they talk to just like-minded people and they make, according to Cass Sunstein anyway, what they tend to do is make each other more and more extreme. Right? The effect of their reasons arguably is precisely because they share the same conclusions, they tend to get further and further away from sensible conclusions, at least if you ask me. And when they share their reasons, they get, it seems like, more poorly reasoned conclusions rather than better. They get more reasoned conclusions, but that the effect of that is to make their new conclusions more indefensible. But the other thing on Twitter is I do see interactions among people, but I have seen this huge epistemic apparatus being developed about why you basically shouldn't trust anybody who disagrees with you. And there's lots of guilt by association techniques, you liked the tweet of this person whom I find reprehensible, so we shouldn't trust you. Or you said this one thing that is a very minor point, but it disagrees with a very minor part of my worldview. So now I'm generally suspicious of you. And so like, it seems what's happening here, and I'd love to be corrected if I'm wrong about this, it seems what's happening here is that it's making us, interacting with other people is making us have worse, more poorly reasoned conclusions. So tell me where I'm wrong.
I don't know. I mean, it's to a large extent, it's an empirical matter and I don't know. I just don't know if that's the case. I mean, I see what you're describing. I see how that does happen, but I'm not sure this is the only thing that happens. And so I don't know whether the more kind of positive interactions outweigh what you're describing. And for instance, like at the beginning of the pandemic, about a year ago now, clearly you had way better information on Twitter than on the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. From our health organizations, clearly, you might even say.
Yeah, indeed, from the health organizations. And clearly, there was among kind of knowledgeable people on Twitter, there was a consensus that was forming that this was really going to be really, really bad, that masks were working. And clearly, it was a better place to be. And so in that case, you could clearly see how people paying attention to the arguments and looking at the science and being careful, where people were very good at figuring out who were the good experts that they should follow, and at kind of coming to a relative consensus on these big questions. So I think in some cases, at least it can work really well.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding the question of kind of echo chambers and all that, it feels that way, but the evidence suggests that actually we have more echo chambers in our real lives than in social media, mm-hmm. Because we're exposed to just way more people on social media than in our everyday lives. And we tend to surround ourselves with people who are like-minded. And so just by the sheer force of number, we're much more likely to be exposed to kind of cross-cutting information on social media than in real life. And also mm-hmm. people are less reluctant to share things that you might disagree with on social media than in real life. So it's not clear how much of that phenomenon is. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist on Twitter. I'm just saying Twitter might not make it worse compared to no Twitter.
Yeah.
And also, even though it's, you know, discussion is can only be helpful if you're disagreeing about something, it is still the case that the more you agree otherwise, the more the easier the discussion will be, because argumentation works by relying on beliefs that we share. So I'm going to take something that you already believe in and try to convince you that that belief is actually more coherent with what I believe than what you believe on the point that we disagree on. And so if we agree about nothing, I can't, you know, I can't even start arguing with you, because I can't, I don't have any leverage. I can't, you know, I can't use any of your beliefs to try to convince you that I'm right, or if we don't trust any of the same sources.
Yeah.
And so what you often see is within people who agree on most things, instead of just talking about the things they already agree on, which indeed would be deleterious, they actually talk about the fine points that they disagree on, and that can be quite helpful. Mm-hmm. So there are certainly corners of Twitter that work quite well, but obviously there are places in which it doesn't really work very well for a number of reasons.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, you know, there's this common narrative about Twitter that arguments on Twitter are really terrible, or arguments on Facebook are really terrible. But maybe, you know, you do have to ask, what's your baseline, right? Compared to what, right? And you know, one of the things that I think has happened in America, at least, I don't know if this is true in France or in other parts of the world, there was this book, I think it was called The Big Sort. And it was talking about how we are sorting ourselves into like-minded enclaves more and more. There's more assortative mating, I think is the word, where people marry people of the same educational background, same income level, yada, yada, yada. And we just get less, because, you know, people are not going to church as much, they're not part of civic organizations as much, there's just less exposure to people from different social strata, different income brackets, different belief sets. And so maybe Twitter is kind of a way to, it's not functionally designed to counteract this, but it maybe has as a positive consequence. But you know, part of me gets the sense that America has drifted apart on a lot of questions, has become more polarized than it used to be. I know in Ezra Klein's book, Why We're Polarized, one of the things he notes is that in the 50s, political scientists were saying we were under-polarized. Yeah. We needed to disagree more.
Yeah, the speak address of the APS saying, you know, people, it's because they are not even visible. They knew so little about you know, programs and politics in general that they thought, well, if people could be a bit more polarized, could have stronger political opinions, then maybe they would also have more informed opinions, which is actually what's happening.
Yeah. So you do think people are getting more informed about politics? I mean,
yeah, they know more about where the parties stand. Yeah.
Yeah. My mom watches, you know, Fox News every day, and she watches what's it called?
OAN.
Newsmax. Newsmax a lot too. I don't know if she watches OAN, but I would say she has definitely become much more informed about politics than I am. She knows the names, she knows the drama, right? She has, you know, some sense of like the policies and what their alleged effects are. I'm not sure how good the information is. And, you know, there's obviously some true information and some false information there. And, but it leads me to the question, do you think people are good at arguing in general? Like, or are they really bad at arguing? Because I know when I ask my students to justify certain of their beliefs, they become very uncomfortable. They don't want to do it. Now, maybe it's just because I'm their professor and they don't want to look stupid, or maybe because they just don't have practice with it. But at the other hand, when those same students come and they ask me for a higher grade, all of a sudden they become much more clever reasoners. So what's happening there?
Well, I guess it is a matter of motivation. And so the context is usually important. So people get better at arguing when they are with other people in a kind of face-to-face discussion in a small group. When, as we were mentioning earlier, when people agree with them on most things, so that they can have some points to use as leverage. When they have no, as you were saying, no pressure. You know, if they're talking with their boss or with their professor, or you know, so you know, when they have no pressure to voice disagreement. And then they also have to talk about something that they care about. Like if they really don't care so much. You know, if you ask them, you know, what is their position on such a kind of, you know, abstruse to some extent, you know, philosophical issue, maybe the opinion that they have is relatively weak, to say the least. And so, you know, justifying that is going to be difficult. And indeed, we know from the work of people like Diana Kuhn that if you ask people to take stand on you know, on policy matters and this sort of things, and you know, most people are going to tell you, oh yeah, I think, you know, I'm for free trade or I'm for, you know, whatever. They will give you some answer, but then if you ask them to justify, most people will be terrible because their opinions are so weak and because it has no, you know, practical consequences for them either way. Whereas, as you are saying, when it's something that you care about, something that you're more informed about, or something that has, you know, practical consequences for you, and all of a sudden you become a little Cicero.
So do you have you thought about? I mean, I don't know. The Jean Nisuo? Don't know.
Jean Nico.
Do you teach students there?
I give a couple of classes. One class for your artist. Yeah.
Are they graduate students or are they undergraduates?
No, they're master students. It doesn't work quite the same way as in the US. So I guess it would be the equivalent of, you know, young grad students, maybe, or something like, kind of in between, or kind of seniors.
Mm-hmm. Now I forgot what I was going to ask, but I guess it was something like, has your research about, you know, motivated reasoning, right? When you care about something, it seems like you at least are a lot better at figuring out various arguments to get it. Have you used this to affect how you teach students? Have you tried to think about ways to make them more motivated to care about seemingly abstruse topics? I mean, your topics are really cool, so they may already be motivated.
But still, I mean, you know, but still. I try to give them, I never thought of it in this way exactly, but I do try to give them as much leeway as possible to find the topic for their final essay, which is going to be most of their grade. A topic that they are interested in, which should help. And I do try to have kind of group discussions, nothing that don't have to be argumentative. That can just be, you know, kind of people kind of, you know, talking with each other about their essays and getting feedback. And we know that, I mean, not these kind of discussions necessarily, but kind of at least structured group discussions, that kind of structured debates are some of the best ways of getting people to actually get better at argumentation. And then they will also get better at solitary argumentation, and they will write better essays, better argued essays on their own on some other topic, mm-hmm. if they've had the experience of arguing with others.
Yeah.
So we know that works. But I'm not trying to get them better at argumentation. That's not the point of that of the class I'm teaching. I'm trying to convey some content. So it's good as a byproduct, but that's not the main point, I guess.
But presumably you would want them, like, the more they care about the content, the more they will start to try to use their understanding of the content they've learned in their day-to-day life. And the more they use that, the more they internalize it, and the more they can sort of transfer it to far contexts of learning. And so I imagine that, like, if they see themselves getting better at a skill that they value, that will be one reason for them to care more about mastering the content. But yeah, I mean, it's a difficult problem. I'm not trying to get you to solve the transfer problem, but just I was just wondering if your theory, given that it sees arguments as to a large degree motivated, mm-hmm. Makes sense of that. Well, we're almost done. I just want to ask one last question, which is about riots. I want to just make sure I understand, because you talk about riots in the book, and it seems like you say two things, at least that's what I recall, two things about riots. First, often when there are riots and people do things like property damage or murder or theft, it's people who were sort of in desperate circumstances or wanted to do that stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And so I was always under the impression that when you're in that people in riots don't have full control of themselves, right? That they there's like what's called a mob mentality, and that people kind of are to a large degree not blameworthy for what they do in riots. And there's a sociologist named Randall Collins who talks mm-hmm. about police behavior during riot circumstances. And he talks about what he calls a forward riot, where police, because of their training, they sort of run forward and they like swinging their batons and stuff and hitting people, but they are also kind of under the influence of these larger forces around them. So to what degree are people responsible for themselves in riots?
Well, I don't, you know, I don't want to make any kind of legal, you know, point about, you know, responsibility and these sort of things, but I think much more than we might like to think. And I think, I guess one point that's important to keep in mind, and that reflects that the importance of people's kind of priors, intentions, and beliefs before going to the riot, is the extraordinary degree of heterogeneity there is in any crowd. Mm-hmm. And you could see that pretty clearly in the Capitol. So first of all, as you were saying, not everybody who was in the crowd went to the actual Capitol, then not everybody tried to actually breach the Capitol, and people felt quite different. Like, for instance, this one example in which a policeman ended up being kind of isolated from kind of drawn towards the crowd. And he really thought people were trying to, you know, reach for his gun, and he really thought apparently he was going to die. And then some other crowd members protected him and allowed him to kind of rejoin the ranks. And so you can see how it's not as if there was not one kind of mob mentality that just, you know, kill them all. And it was like some people were clearly out there for to be violent, and other people were out there to serve other goals. And so, and it's not, and there was no kind of contagion. So there are other kind of interesting phenomena, you know, like the typical kind of stuff that, you know, Malcolm Gladwell talked, kind of popularized at some point, the Granovetter type of effect, in which, you know, let's say everybody kind of maybe wants a little bit to do a riot, but, you know, one person is really so extreme that they, even if they're just on their own, essentially, they're gonna try to do it. And then some other person thinks, oh yeah, there's one other person, I'm gonna do it. And then, you know, if there are two other people, I'm gonna do it. And so, you know, it feels as if everybody wants the same thing, but in fact, people had very, very different kind of prior attitudes and beliefs, because it's, for some people, it's so extreme that they would be able to do it on their own. For other, they were only gonna do it when they had kind of strength in number, and they were pretty confident that they would not suffer any personal consequences. So it's not, and that in that case, it's not this kind of this crazy, you know, I'm being taken away by the mob. It's just completely rational estimation of, okay, so now, you know, I can probably do these crazy things that I kind of wanted to do, but without paying any cost. So, you know, why not do them now?
Okay, so you're not denying the phenomenon of social contagion. You're just saying,
but that's not social contagion. If Granovetter type of theory is right, it's not contagion in the fact that it's not your idea to, oh, okay, we should have a riot that makes me want to have a riot. It's the fact that you're starting to do this, then it changes the parameters of the situation so that now it makes sense for me to do it.
Right, so let me just be clear.
Contagion, yeah.
So contagion would be almost like a disease where you get it and it overcomes your rational faculties. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is that a lot of people have different assessments of when they should and shouldn't do things. So they want some degree of social approval, and that degree of social approval they want before they're willing to do whatever it is they want to do varies from person to person. So some people are such that they'll do it regardless of whether or not there's any social approval. And some people are like, they only need a small degree of social approval before they feel comfortable doing it, before they feel like I have enough of a team here where I feel safe. Mm-hmm. And other people, they need lots and lots of people before they feel safe. And so, this is what Gladwell, I don't know who came up with the term, the slow motion riot, but the thought is that, yeah, if one person does it, I won't do it. But if two people does it, I'll do it. And now somebody's, if three people does it, I'll do it. And so, or sorry, if three people do it, I'll do it.
Yeah.
But in each of these cases is the thought that, it's not the thought that they all wanted to do this. It's rather that there's this complicated play. Some people wanted to do the thing that was disapproved of, and some people just want to be part of the group. So like, if you're like, there's suicide riots or whatever you want to call them, where if 99 famous people killed themselves, maybe I'll kill myself too, because I'm worried they must be having a good reason to do it. So I better do it. Whereas some people just want to kill themselves and they'll do it even if everybody tells them no. And then there's a bunch of people in between kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the case of suicide, I guess it doesn't really work because not that many people want to do that. But that's kind of the idea. And so it's not just social approval. I mean, when in the case of a riot, it's not just that you will suffer fewer reputational consequences if you take part in a riot, in a big riot, but also that there's like the legal consequences, the chances of actually being caught, you know, breaking, you know, stealing stuff, or you know, engaging in violence is much lower if you're in a large crowd than if you're on your own.
So there's like a rational choice explanation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, then again, I'm not saying it's all a conscious decision, but the cognitive mechanisms underlying that don't have to be irrational, though.
Okay, well, thanks to you, I'm no longer going to try to start a riot. Okay.